Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure for me to welcome you to the afternoon's Counterpoint with Dr. Otto Kernberg. Those of you who do not know, Dr. Thomas Zaz was snowed in New York, and he will be unable to attend the conference, and so we are most fortunate to have Dr. Scott Miller jump into the breach, so to speak, and be the discussant of Dr. Kernberg's talk. So without further ado, talking about the almost untreatable narcissistic patient, I introduce to you, with great pleasure, Dr. Otto Kernberg.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Can you hear me well in the last row? Yeah? Last row over there? Can you hear me? Okay, good. Before touching the subject of the almost untreatable narcissistic patients, I think it needs to be said that in general, within the whole field of severe personality disorders, the narcissistic personalities at all levels present the greatest challenges to treatment. I spoke this morning about transference-focused psychotherapy treatment we developed at our Institute for Personality Disorders to treat the personality of patients with severe personality disorders. In other words, it is a treatment geared to bring about significant personality change rather than being directed to symptomatic improvement only. And we assume that the treatment of the personality in toto will permit the resolution of associated symptoms. In this regard, the strategy of treatment differs from that of cognitive behavioral therapies that are geared to directly deal with symptom and improve concrete symptoms and even concrete patterns of behavior rather than changes in the personality in toto. The treatment that we have developed for severe personality disorders is geared to resolve the identity diffusion from which these patients suffer. That is to say, the absolute splitting of their representation of self and their representation of significant others into a segment of idealized views of self and others and a devalued or persecutory view of self and others, so that the lack of integration of the concept of self and the lack of integration of the concept of significant others, that is to say the syndrome of identity diffusion, constitutes the basic key to the pathology and to the treatment geared to modify it and resolve it. The narcissistic personalities are one of the types, the most frequent types of severe personality disorder. In fact, probably the most frequent type, about 30% of the patients with severe personality disorder that we see present a narcissistic personality disorder. And the problem is that narcissistic personality disorders present along a broad spectrum of severity, so that the healthiest, under quote, of them look like patients with a neurotic personality organization with less severe personality disorders. They don't look at all like a severe personality disorder at first look. And the worst of them look like patients with borderline personality disorder, and only a careful differential diagnosis shows that they are narcissistic personalities functioning on an overt borderline level. We make that differential diagnosis by studying the nature of their object relations. The ordinary patient with borderline personality disorder has chaotic relations with others and with self, but has a clinging, dependent, ambivalent, chaotic relations with others. The narcissistic personality functioning at a borderline level is rather isolated, has a distant, cool, grandiose, or demanding, enraged attitude, but lacks the capacity for a dependent, actual dependent relationships, relationship with others, and is basically distant, and also has great difficulties naturally to get engaged in a psychotherapeutic treatment, easily gets frustrated and breaks off the treatment. His capacity for object relations is much weaker than that of ordinary borderline patients, although on the surface he may be functioning much better. So I think we should first define levels of functioning of the personality disorder and then describe their main general symptoms, to then go into specific cases that have particularly severe prognostic indicators in their symptoms, in their personality structure, or in the process during the treatment that they evolve. Let's start with a description of the general common features of the narcissistic personality disorder. And I'm doing that because, although I assume you all know the classification, narcissistic personality disorder is described on the DSM classification, it is not a fully satisfactory description in depth, and sometimes doesn't lend itself really to a complete differential diagnosis in difficult cases. The narcissistic personality has three major diagnostic features. First, an element of grandiosity derived from the pathological, from a pathological grandiose self that replaces the fragmented, split, normal self-representation with an artificial, so to speak, secondary pathological self that, as the word says, has a grandiose quality and constitutes a kind of a band-aid that protects them from the conflictual, intimate relation of the ordinary borderline patients. This characteristic of the grandiose self is, at a descriptive level, self-centeredness, over-dependence on admiration from others, fantasies of success and grandiosity, avoidance of realities that run counter to the high opinion of himself, and bouts of insecurity that disrupt in strange way the overall sense of grandiosity. With it goes very often a sense of entitlement and an assumption of rights go beyond those that he grants to others, and the infringement of which enrages him. A second major characteristic of these patients is the predominance of the affect of envy, a complicated, primitive affect secondary to primary rage, and different from ordinary hatred in the sense that, in a paradox way, what is envied is something that one feels is good, but one doesn't have, that should belong to one, but somebody else has it. In contrast to hatred of an enemy whom you want to destroy, which is a primary affect, hatred, rage, let's say rage. Hatred is already a secondary elaboration of it. But envy is envy then of something good, and in expressing envy and destroying the envied object, the patient at the bottom destroys what he needs and therefore ends up empty, a major source of conflicts. The envy in this Envy is a universal affect that everybody has to some extent, but normally doesn't control life as it does in the case of these patients. It is both conscious and unconscious, so that some patients don't experience it consciously, are defended against it very often by a secondary devaluation, what at the bottom, the envy. But other patients suffer from conscious envy practically all the time, in addition to even major sources of it at an unconscious level. There is a quality of greediness and exploitiveness in these patients, combined, as already mentioned, with devaluation, what they don't have, what they don't acquire, an incapacity to depend on others, because to depend means to accord value to others. So it might be a source of envy and of feeling of inferiority, and they can't tolerate it. So the defenses against envy at the bottom make them incapable of depending on others. As I mentioned earlier already, very different from what we find in ordinary borderline patients. A lack of empathy with others, a strange shallowness, emotional shallowness, although on the surface they may seem to express feelings freely, talk normally. Case of intelligent, educated, cultured person, they seem to deal with the world of emotions, but when it comes to personal relations, that sense of shallowness shows in their own perception that they really cannot feel in depth, and they have difficulty in committing themselves to work, to a profession, and particularly to an intimate relationships. A third major characteristic, and this feeling of envy is really connected with the basic, primitive aggression that has evolved into envy, and that at a deeper level is connected with the entire underlying borderline structure, the split of relationship into idealized and devalued or persecutory ones. A third major characteristic is a deficit in their internalized value systems. In psychoanalytic lingo, deficit in their superego structure, which is related to the fact that the internalization of value systems that we get from our parents and from society, the do's and don'ts that determine what we think are the behaviors that we should aspire to, those that we should avoid, the building blocks of our internal moral conscience are missing here, because that which they see as ideal demands of what they should aspire to is incorporated by them as if it were part of their grandiose self. They already are as good, as perfect as they should be to be accepted by themselves and to be accepted by others. And so the primitive superego, from which they have extracted the idealized demands and put it into their own personality, I am as good as the person whom I admire, leave them as guide, as ethical and moral guidepost only with the negative demands, you should not, which they don't tolerate because they usually have a primitive, sadistic quality having to do with the primitive conflicts around aggression that they project outside, seeing therefore early prohibitions and demands as excessive and as sadistic and aggressive, and so that projection of aggression makes internalized prohibition that would become internalized from those onto whom they have projected their own aggressive tendencies intolerable. So they reproject prohibitions into the outside. This is what is demanded outside and doesn't need to be respected by somebody as good, as great as they are. So for those mechanisms, there is a weakening of the internalized superego structure. And that shows in the mildest cases by a strange remaining of their value system at an infantile level, lack of maturation of the internalized value system, and in more severe cases by antisocial behavior. And antisocial behavior, which we find spread throughout all severe personality disorders, is particularly frequent in narcissistic personality disorders, needs to be evaluated in all cases, even those that on the surface seem to be functioning best. Example, I examined a university professor in the arts, severe narcissistic personality. I'm not giving you details about here, except that I raised, as I usually do with narcissistic personalities, the question, have you ever had inclination of do things that might get you in trouble with the law that are dangerous, or have you had any trouble with the law? And he looked at me and said, how do you know? I said, how do you know what? And so he told me, he was a professor in the arts, and he told me that he stole books, but only expensive art books, because all this bourgeois mediocrity who would have the money to buy those books didn't really appreciate them. He appreciated them, and he felt he had the moral right, and he was very good at it. Nobody would ever suspect, and he was doing this with a clear sense that he was the ideal person to understand them, use them for teaching, use them in a way in which the usual person who had the money to buy them would not. So there you have an illustration of one aspect of antisocial behavior in a person who was functioning at a very high level in terms of ordinary social criteria. But of course, the more severe the overall functioning, the more severe the antisocial tendencies may be. And the extraordinary importance of them is that they are one of the two aspects of the functioning of the patient that determine prognosis more than anything else. The psychotherapeutic treatment of all severe personality disorders, including, of course, the narcissistic personality disorder, those two major prognostic indicators are the severity of antisocial features and secondary gain of illness. And by secondary gain of illness, I mean the utilization of the very illness for secondary benefits, consciously or unconsciously, that tend to reinforce the pathology and be one more motivation directed against the treatment, one more of the features that make some cases almost untreatable. So, in the milder cases, that problem the internalized value system shows an incapacity to mourn, the tendency towards severe mood swings instead of the usual capacity for sad moods and melancholic feelings, either feeling perfectly all right or severe characterological depression. What has been called a shame culture rather than a guilt culture. They don't steal because they would be caught and would put it to shame, not because they would feel guilty about it. And childlike values in what determines self-esteem. If a five-year-old child feels good because it has beautiful toys, it's well-dressed, it looks beautiful, everybody looks at it on the street, that's perfectly normal. But when you have a 40-year-old man who has to dress up dramatically, who has to have an open red car, somehow by the way of presenting himself has to catch everybody's attention, then you have a kind of a childlike basis for feeling valuables. And this is remarkable even in otherwise intelligent and cultured individual. Now, these tendencies, however, become in the more severe cases accompanied by clearly antisocial behavior, either passive-aggressive, stealing, lying, chronic irresponsibility with money, conning, or aggressive behavior, destruction of objects, attack on people, severe attack on people severe lesions, and murder. At the end, in the most severe cases, we have the antisocial personality proper, which is the most severe manifestation of pathological narcissism. In our present classification, it's classified as if it were an independent personality structure different from the narcissistic personality, because the present classification of personality disorder is purely categorical and misses the dimensional aspect. This is now generally recognized as a major problem, and the classification on DSM-5 will hopefully combine both dimensional and categorical criteria and will hopefully indicate that narcissistic personalities function in a spectrum that goes, as we can now describe, from the mildest cases that look as if they had a, quote, neurotic structure. They function very well in the major areas of life, apparently, except that in intimate relations they have chronic problems in intimate love relations, serious problems in their love relations, problems with people at work and with work that sometimes inhibits their progression, their promotion, and subtle difficulties in their social life, in intimacy and in creativity. A second, more severe level is the typical one with all the characteristics that I mentioned before. Usually these patients have significant problems in those three major areas: love and sex, work and profession, social life and creativity. And then there are patients who function at an overt borderline level, who have a breakdown in those three major areas: generalized impulsivity, lack of impulse control, chaotic behavior, and are very often misdiagnosed as borderline patients when you don't look at the underlying grandiosity, accentuated problems around envy, and of course the possibility of antisocial behavior with a particularly severe syndrome in which you have narcissistic personality, antisocial behavior, egosyntonic aggression, chronic egosyntonic aggression directed against self or others. These are the narcissistic self-mutilators, as well as the people who are chronically violent under certain circumstances, and a paranoid tendency, that underlying projection of their aggression on others who seem to be as dangerous enemies, now shows clearly and is no longer compensated by the grandiosity of the pathological sense. That is the syndrome of malignant narcissism, characterized, to mention it once again, by narcissistic personality, antisocial behavior, egosyntonic aggression, and paranoid orientation. In addition, all along, at all levels, these patients have a particular problem in their chronic self-experience, feelings of emptiness and boredom, chronic boredom and emptiness that they can fill up very often with drugs or exciting experiences. It's one of the origins that leads to drug abuse and dependency, and stimulus hunger, which fosters addictions. There are certain frequent complications. Sexual promiscuity, as well as sexual inhibition. Perhaps the sexual inhibition, when they are afraid of not functioning sexually, and then we find that particularly in men, some cases of impotence derive from a fear of not being the greatest and most effective, most powerful man, and the inhibition protects them against the sense of being humiliated for not being the most fantastical, the functioning one. The sexual promiscuity that used to be particularly a problem in men now is more frequent also in women, related to cultural factors, that has provided much more freedom to women, much less culturally determined economic dependency and culturally determined rejection of women's sexual independence in a patriarchal society. So the road to sexual promiscuity for narcissistic personalities in women is open, as it was all along, given the double morality that operated for men in the patriarchal system. So that we find this both in men and in women, and it's typically a combination of falling in love, infatuation, an unconscious sense of envy. For example, a patient of mine who, every attractive woman was something teasing him. He had to get her. It was unfair that he shouldn't be able to have her, and he conquered her, and then he had sex with her. And after a few weeks, he felt bored, not interested, left her, on to the next. And so at first, in their 20s and 30s, patients may be very happy with, and for women, we find the same thing, wonderful men, they have to seduce, they are happy with them, and then they get bored, on to the next. And the only men who continue interesting are those who are unavailable. The only women who are absolutely wonderful, who those men can't have. So the underlying dynamic is the unconscious envy of what they feel is being withheld from them, a kind of greedy appropriation, and then the unconscious devaluation of what they envied and now they have and no longer need, and on to the next. Gradually, in their 40s and 50s, this becomes a major problem for women earlier than for men, because of the biological limit in having children, and very often narcissistic women who don't want to have children in their 20s because it's somebody who depends on them, who are going to limit them, limits their freedom, then feel, hey, I need a woman, or I need a baby, all my friends have babies, I need that too, get desperate over having a baby in their 40s, and that may lead them to treatment, in the sense that now not being able to establish a relationship, to get married, becomes a major problem. And the same for men who used to be happy Don Juans in their 20s and 30s. At 40s, it becomes a problem, a source of anxiety, and again, patients may look for treatment. This brings me to the general prognosis of these cases. The most severe cases of narcissistic personality already show in childhood, between ages 5 to 7. It used to be thought that personality disorders don't exist in childhood and only develop in late adolescence. That is a social bias that slowly is disappearing as we learn more about psychopathology of children. The importance of diagnosing that in childhood is that they are eminently treatable, and much easier and much shorter time to be treated than in the case of later treatment in adulthood. During adolescence, those most cases that are not severe ones tend to go underground. The social structure of adolescence protects all except the most severe cases from creating problems for themselves. But those who show severe problems in adolescence, again, are severe cases. Narcissistic personalities then function much better after adolescence, usually so well that they don't go into treatment. Treatment is humiliation and inferiorization, and they function very well. They only go to treatment if they have some particular symptom that they want to get rid of. And very often the indication is symptomatic treatment because they are not ready to really look at their personality in total. And only after 40, ages 40 or 50, we see many patients because when they start having problems with health, with loss of youth, beauty, success, power, depression sets in, a frequent secondary complication of narcissistic personality at that stage. And by the same token, however, their prognosis for treatment improves, and fundamental changes of the personality may often be achieved in that crucial time around the early or middle 40s. I have tried to give you an overall description of the syndrome that already contains some prognostic consideration. And now I'd like to present typical clinical cases with accent on the severity, prognostic severity. But it seems to me that perhaps before doing that, I should briefly say something about the general psychodynamic treatment of these patients. I'm talking both of transference-focused psychotherapy that I described this morning, psychoanalytically derived specific psychotherapy for severe personality disorders that is carried out on a 2 sessions per week basis with significant modification from psychoanalysis proper, that we have we have manualized at our Institute for Personality Disorders and researched empirically regarding its efficacy, and are continuing carrying out research in that regard. One kind of psychodynamic treatment and psychoanalysis proper that with a growing understanding of the psychodynamics of the narcissistic personalities has developed effective ways of treatment of these patients since the early 1960s, and now I would say is an effective treatment for patients functioning at a neurotic level with neurotic personality organization, as well as for patients with a severe personality disorder, but a narcissistic personality disorder of the kind of better functioning narcissistic personality disorder that makes them appear as if they were at a neurotic level. There, the indication is for psychoanalysis. For those who show clearly borderline features, transference-focused psychotherapy would seem to us the treatment of choice. Many of these patients improve with this treatment, but we also find patients who are extremely resistant, and of course, regarding those cases, is the accent of my presentation at this point. General development in a treatment. The basic problem of this patient is an incapacity to depend. They feel they to be treated is to be humiliated or inferiorized. So, and they have to be as good as the therapist. And that means that the therapist has to be as good as they. They take what the therapist says some careful, suspicious, evaluating attitude, it has to be as good as they, because if the therapist is not good enough, he gets devalued and is dismissed. And if the therapist seems to be better, if he has ideas they haven't had, if he has suggestions they haven't thought about, then there's a danger that they feel humiliated, they can't tolerate that. So he has to be as good as them, but not better. And that shows in the treatment, in that the therapist feels constantly under a kind of control of the patient. Every one of his utterances is carefully being evaluated. A patient of mine responded to each interpretation, and I had a sense of relief. The patients replace using what comes from the therapist with an ongoing self-analysis. The therapist becomes the witness to their self-analysis. Sometimes patients who are in analysis on the couch, the analyst sits behind them and the analyst makes a comment. The patient has a startled reaction. He has forgotten that the analyst is in the room. They tend to intellectually appropriate themselves from the interpretation. The therapist finds his own theory repeated by the patient as if it were an understanding that the patient has achieved by himself, but it doesn't help him any. It's an intellectual formulation. It's a learning, but not an emotional learning dealing to internal transformation. There's an intense competition with the therapist and a view of the therapist. The therapist must be like them, basically indifferent, only out for the money or for the prestige, and or treating them only because he's forced to, but cannot have an authentic interest in them. There is an easy devaluation and contempt for the therapist, and sometimes an oscillation between an apparent intense idealization. A patient came to see me after two sessions. They said, I knew it, that you were going to help me. You have an understanding that nobody else has had for me. That is absolutely fantastic. This is the treatment that I needed. And then after the session, I got the telephone call. I'm going to see Dr. So-and-so, but I'm not sure whether I'm going to continue the treatment. He didn't continue the treatment with me. So there is a defensive, frail idealization. So the greatest therapist becomes the devalued therapist in no time. And an ongoing effort and omnipotent control to avoid both devaluation and envy of the therapist. And at the same time, there develops gradually the manifestation of unconscious envy or conscious envy of the therapist that shows particularly in a very typical syndrome, negative therapeutic reaction out of unconscious envy. For months, the patient may complain, nothing is going on. I've heard everything that you are saying already. What's new? I can repeat everything you're going to say. And there's a session where you say something, the patient's impressed. It seems that everything is moving, and there are real feeling. You feel finally there's been a breakthrough. You come to the next session, and this patient starts out, nothing is going on in this treatment, and you're not helping me. And you say, do you remember last session? Last session, what about it? Do you remember? No, I don't remember. And the patient honestly has eliminated, and not only eliminated, but maybe feeling worse after he feels that you have helped him, because unconsciously this has meant a humiliation. So it is a very typical, at first a puzzling response, but once you understand and you are able to get back to that which produced the envy, it is possible to resolve it. And that's one of the moments in which then eventually some change may occur. The patient, of course, is also afraid of being devalued and depreciated by the therapist. He cannot believe that anybody is interested in him, that anybody would really be interested and respect him, even if the patient has problems. And the combination of envy and projected envy makes for long periods of very difficult time. At a deeper level, the patient is particularly envious of the therapist's capacity to maintain the contact with him and to maintain interest in him. He wants the therapist to maintain interest, but that capacity shows the patient what he's not capable of. So a man gets involved with a woman, wants to maintain the relationship, although he's devaluing her. She, in spite of his bad treatment, continues loving him, and he is envious of her capacity to love him, and that contributes to his devaluation of her. It is a almost frightening, painful manifestation of this pathology. Gradually, the patient starts projecting onto the therapist components of his own pathological grandiose self that is a condensation of all the ideal, admired, and superior person whom he has taken into himself. And as we resolve this gradually in the treatment, the pathological grandiose self becomes resolved. For example, one patient during a time when I was candidate for becoming director of a psychiatric hospital in a small town in the Midwest, the patient, a psychiatrist in that same town, started in treatment with me, started spreading rumors about me, about the terrible way in which I was behaving in the session, before the session, after the session, all the ridiculous things about me he knew. And after a few weeks, he heard those comments about me, that gossip, to come back to him. Others told him that which he has started into circulation. He became frightened and in a session confessed to me that he had been circulating these stories. You can imagine how I reacted. I was also significantly younger and had less experience with these patients. I was ready to end the treatment in order to protect him from just killing him. I was in the middle of a very competitive situation. I had supervision from a very wise expert, one of the great precursors in the analytic treatment narcissistic patients, Herman van der Waals, and who recommended patients and pointed out to me that there may be significant transference elements that eventually might be clarified. And sure enough, it turned out that the patient, that reflection about his behavior reminded him of his mother, a woman from the poor area of the small town where he was born, who married the local famous great physician, always felt inferior, not accepted as part of the society of the town, and who dedicated herself to denigrate and raise gossip, malicious gossip about everybody else to elevate herself. And the patient knew this, hated it, and admired it, and it was clear that he had become identified with that part of his mother as part of his own pathological grandiose self. And in understanding that, it resolved one aspect of his personality, his sadistic devaluation of other people. So it paid off to be patient, and I'm illustrating the gradual decomposition of the grandiose self that then leads to the underlying severe conflict around more primitive aggression, paranoid transferences, intense rage, intense depressive episodes, and it becomes more like the ordinary treatment of borderline patients, while patients suffer much more, are much more chaotic, but are able to begin to feel for others, to overcome the devastating cancerous envy. And one of my patients in that stages, in that stage of treatment, became aware of his ongoing hostile devaluation of his wife, his admiration of her, his secret envy of aspects of her feminine personality, his wishes in the past of being a woman, which he was now horrified to recognize, and the wish to be both sexes at the same time is a deep unconscious fantasy in many narcissistic personalities. And he started to admire his wife as well, to appreciate the good aspects that she had, feeling guilty and depressed over his treatment of her, the wishes to repair the relationship, and wishes to repair the relationship with me that in his fantasy had been destroyed or affected or damaged by his ongoing attacks on me. And so the pathological narcissism gradually got resolved with the development of a more normal underlying self, in contrast to the pathological grandiose one, a normal internalized system of values, and the capacity for a deeper relation, not only in his marriage, but with his work and with his colleagues. So, which are the cases in which this is most difficult, and that really in that regard most threatening? First of all, here comes the list of the 10 plagues. First of all, chronic work failure, in contrast to capabilities, because patients unconsciously can't learn. They have to be either CEO or they can't do it. They cannot ascend gradually. They have to be at the top. And if they are not at the top, they devalue what they're doing, which is, of course, crazily damaging. And there are patients who then avoid all commitment to work to avoid facing that conflict. And if on top of this they develop anxiety over having to work, anxiety or depression because they're not appreciated, because they can't do what they really should do, and then they get social supports, SSI, SSD, supported housing. You may have somebody who chronically gets supported in such a completely miserable passive stance, but they prefer to be a sick person who has not been understood by anybody and is at least getting that advantage, rather than somebody exposed to the humiliation of having to work into a certain position. If the patients have a rich relative, that is, of course, even more so. A medical student was sent to treatment with me, and his father paid the treatment while he was a medical student. As soon as he was a physician, he was ready, he was supposed to participate in paying for the treatment, and the patient told me, I'll be glad to go to treatment as long as my father pays for it. This whole thing is useless, but it's fine, I'm doing it anyhow. And I worked on that for the 2 years that he was still in medical school, but the day he received the service, he said, okay, they are no longer paying for this treatment, so thank you for everything. And from one day to the next, he left. Another patient who was suffering because of the sense of chronic envy, inferiority, emptiness, homosexual, was living with a very wealthy partner who was offering to pay for the treatment. His friend was offering to pay, even told me, if you wish, I pay you the entire treatment ahead. And I said I did not accept that. And that patient who had graduated as a major profession and who would have had no problem in finding work the next day, I told him that I expected as part of the treatment that he would work. And he looked at me as if I had told him that he had to dance naked on Times Square. And he said that under these circumstances, he certainly would not accept to treat. I mean, it seemed to him that I had suggested the most impossible thing of the world, given the fact that he was being kept by his friend and having a luxurious life. And here I was making impossible demands. Who was I, given his value? This is one type where secondary gain may be so enormous that treatment under such circumstances is not possible. Another case is where antisocial behavior is so severe and that there are not sufficient guarantees for dangerous behavior. A patient who was HIV positive, narcissistic personality with pedophilia, and I made it a strict condition that he would avoid any sexual contacts with a minor. At the same time, letting him know that, of course, he could lie to me, he could cheat, but eventually that would come out, and if he cheated, the treatment was useless. Wouldn't be worthwhile for him to try. It would be a waste of time if he expected to get anything from me under such circumstances. And that treatment did not work out. I must confess I was relieved because I was really afraid by that situation. There are patients who have drug dependency. They can be treated, but first the drug dependency has to be treated. So detoxification, rehabilitation at 6 months without any drug or alcohol are reasonable preconditions for treating these patients. Otherwise, the gratification of the drug prevents any significant change in the affective development in the treatment, because the treatment is highly dependent on the development and the difficulty of development of an affective situation in the hour. Another situation are patients who have inordinate arrogance. In other words, there is, to begin with, such depreciation of the person whom they're consulting, that there is not sufficient space to give themselves a chance for a try. Example, one patient came to see me. I had been highly recommended. She Googled me and reacted very negatively to what she thought was excessive things in Google. That was all probably propaganda I was spreading to make myself important. She decided to simultaneously consult two or three other people, found somebody very much in disagreement with what I was doing, decided to buy a set of tapes for self-treatment, started the treatment with me, while at the same time starting treatment with somebody else and comparing the sessions, and the self-tapes, the self-improvement tapes, about which I knew nothing, except that I was surprised when about her sophisticated knowledge when she said, there are other therapists who think that such and such means such and such, and she had all kind of knowledge about all kind of therapies, and it sounded all very knowledgeable. I asked her, sure, you've had no training in psychology or no training, but she had the powerful set of records of sets. At one point I felt almost tempted to study them myself to tell her I've so in the countertransference, I became, finally the patient interrupted the treatment. It is sometimes difficult to judge that, but usually these are patients who don't have the capacity for a minimum trust, and they go doctor shopping for many years until sometimes they finally are able to stop that and enter into a treatment arrangement. How much time do I have? 5 minutes. I suspected that. There are some patients who have who looks at the surface as suicidal attempts as part of a borderline conditions, but they really have a different kind of suicidal tendency. It is a deep sense that they can end life at any point, and that if the world doesn't give them what they want, they can say goodbye, dear world. And in contrast to everybody else, afraid of illness or death, they are not. They can hurt themselves. They can deeply damage themselves while everybody else gets frightened. And that gives them a sense of superiority that constitutes such an extraordinary secondary gain that nothing can eliminate that. One of our patients, severe narcissistic personality, chronic characterological depression, consumed rat poison. She was treated by one of our good therapists in the hospital, but the patient who denied that she was taking rat poison continued with the prolongation of her protrombin time. In other words, the loss of the clotting capability of the blood, and with internal hemorrhages, searches, careful searches, never were able to discover the rat poison. And we finally had to discharge her to a medical service under condition of severe internal bleeding after a month of an effort to work through the combination of honesty and triumphant self-mutilation. Another patient would cut the tendons. Veins and arteries had lost fingers, finally lost a hand, set fire to her apartment, after 3 years of treatment with one of our best well-trained therapists, she had already tried all kind of cognitive behavioral gestalt analytic treatments of the world, finally went into a prison for the mentally ill because of the fire setting, and probably I have lost touch with the case, but by this time, well, may be dead. So there are some patients in which there is a secret grandiosity connected with that kind of suicidal behavior, which is not impulsive, not suddenly, not linked with severity of depression, but it's a long-term, chronically triumphant sense of superiority expressed in this way. Sometimes that can be treated and resolved. A patient with skin cancer who for months hid from me his skin cancer until he finally was able to, quote, confess it in the context of my analyzing his ongoing sense of superiority and triumph over me, who was trying to help him. A final case is that of the so-called syndrome of the dead mother described by Andre Green, that consists in an apparent indifference to everything. The patient looks as if he were chronically depressed, except he doesn't have typical symptoms of depression and has an attitude, so what else are you going to do? So what? And who professes he doesn't have any interest in what the therapist is saying. He has his reaction is that all of this is totally worthless and senseless, a chronic devaluation of others, and what may only be described as an empty, triumphant sense of superiority. The dynamics of these patients very often are an unconscious identification with a severely depressed mother who evolved the fantasy that the mother was really dead and not available, and an identification with her and achieving a strange unity with such a dead mother by destroying all relationships with others, dismantling everything, including the self, except that dead mother self. And these patients usually, they may not commit suicide, but their life ends in an empty withdrawal. Of course, many of these patients are treated for depression from all kind of medications and electroshock and don't respond to anything. And some of these cases can be helped by the possibility of analyzing this deep relationship, but that is possible in some cases, not in others. I have not been able to give you a complete view of a very complex field, but I hope at least sufficient for you to realize both the severity of the illness, sometimes the difficulty of recognizing behind a surface facade, and the possibility of help and hope, knowing and understanding the dynamics, but the limits of our capacity to help, the danger of becoming omnipotent as a therapist. Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome here. I'm not Tom Saz. I'm actually Scott Miller, and you can. Thanks very much. I'm filling in for Tom, who of course was waylaid in New York. I met him at the last Evolution conference, actually, and what an incredible person! What an honor to be with Dr. Kernberg today and comment on his remarks here. I sort of wondered if Jeff Zeig, when he emailed me at 6:30 this morning to ask me to do this, if there was some kind of Ericksonian thing in this, some suggestion, the almost untreatable narcissistic patient, if he was saying something about me. But I'll try not to think that everything's about me as I respond. You know, this 25 years ago that I was actually wearing a red hat and being a volunteer at this very conference, and to be standing here now, it's really awe-inspiring, frankly, to be part of this. So I'm impressed, of course, with the experience, the passion, the confidence, and the thoroughness with which Dr. Kernberg approaches not only this subject, but his work and his method of transference-focused psychotherapy. You know, I may not be the best discussant. My experience over the last 20 years is in a very different realm. I've worked at a series of small free clinics in Milwaukee and Chicago, dealing primarily with homeless clients and then clients on the margins of society, economically and otherwise. And so my clients, it seems, are very often concerned about safety. and eating and things lower on Maslow's hierarchy of needs than the kinds of things we're talking about a bit here during this presentation. I hope that you'll keep this in mind as I make these very brief comments in response to the material that Dr. Kernberg has so aptly presented this afternoon. And I want to react mostly at what I would consider the unstated in the presentation, the assumed, or what I would call the paradigm level of the discussion. It's things that we don't often talk about, and it's like the air we breathe. You don't notice it until the air is either fouled or until you're gasping for it. It's that paradigm that we all operate within that guides the assumptions that we make and the actions that we take when we meet with the clients that we meet with. And there are two dominant paradigms in the field, or I should say there's one dominant and one minor paradigm that operate in our field. Let me just state what I think those are. The first one, and you can read about this on either my website at scottdmiller.com, or you can go to, that's D, you have to have a D in there. If you don't have the D, then you'll end up at scottmiller.com, and that's not me. It's actually a Nashville bluegrass musician's website. That first paradigm is the medical paradigm. And stating that paradigm simply is that there is an illness inside the person. That's the number one idea. There is an illness. In this case, a narcissism or a personality disorder. Number two, that the way to solve this in order of steps is that first you have to see it and see its severity, which is an interesting idea. It fits part and parcel with that medical view. And let me just say, I have nothing against medicine. I like medicine. When I go to the doctor and I say, hey, doc, it hurts over here, the last thing I want to hear from the doctor is, well, what do you think it is? Because that's what I'm paying the person for, to be smarter than me about that stuff. First, there's an illness. The illness is inside the person. However that's caused, the assumption is that we can know it. We can diagnose it, and then we can also apply a treatment, much like we apply salve to a wound or a drug to an infectious disease. The model is vertical in nature. There is something at the surface and something underneath. And if we don't get to the underneath, then we may just be treating the symptoms, as we do in the common cold. There is no cure, but we treat the symptoms. If you have a strep throat, we can actually cure you with a drug that attacks those the factors that cause that particular disease. This is an idea. It's a paradigm. It's a model. And even in medicine, it doesn't work very well. It works for a handful of conditions or slightly more. And this paradigm is something we live and breathe, and we rarely question that particular paradigm. It's exemplified. It's on every TV show typically, on the Good Morning Show, on the Today Show. We're making progress in medicine. We figured out the problem and the cause, and now we're working on the particular treatments. The outcomes are determined, of course, by two primary things. Did you get the diagnosis right, and did you do the treatment right? Are you following me here? All right, so that's, and we end up in a circle. So if the client's not getting better, then there's really only a couple things to do. We go back and revisit the diagnosis, replumb that, or the treatment must be wrong, or there must be something wrong with the quality of the treatment. If none of those things are there, then it may just be the patient. There's something strange with them that our treatment doesn't work with them. The other paradigm is called the contextual paradigm. You may never have heard about this before. The person who's written most about this is Bruce Wampold at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, happens to be a former professor of mine. The contextual model, in contrast to the medical model, is a horizontal model, and it assumes that there are factors far beyond diagnosis and treatment that really makes a difference. And here's what they are. What you're doing, your treatment approach, what you're doing, where that treatment is done, the context in which the services are offered, and most importantly, who provides that treatment. Interestingly enough, of all three of those factors in the research that our team does, this is what emerges as the most important determinant of outcome. who treated the patient. Was it that therapist or this one over here? If you were treated by that therapist, then you tended to get better. If you're treated by another therapist, your outcomes are more average or poor. Let that sink in a minute. It's a fairly radical statement because most of us can go about our daily business assuming that if the patient doesn't get better, wrong treatment, wrong diagnosis, something wrong about the client that didn't fit with our treatments. What this is saying is if what you're doing doesn't work, you better look in the mirror. It may have something to do with you as a person. 9% of the variability in treatment outcomes is attributable to the therapist, 1% to the treatment model, diagnosis, psychosocial history. Add all those things together, they don't make a hill of beans difference compared to who happens to meet with the client at that day. We know this in medicine, by the way. It's not the scalpel that determines the outcome of the surgery. It's the hand that wields that scalpel. And so this is my thought as I listen to some of the comments. What we've been arguing for instead of that medical model in the contextual model is that therapists begin to watch what they do, monitor and measure their outcomes. Because if it's not primarily the diagnosis and the treatment, then maybe it's something about the fit between you and that particular patient on this day in this place. This has implications for what we do when the treatment is not working. So far, in the comparisons dating back 30 years, the ones our team did, three of them last year, fairly sophisticated, involved meta-analyses of a wide variety of problems, we find no difference in outcome between treatment approaches. We come back to, once again, the therapist and the particular treatment. But let me give you one example of a study done on transference-focused psychotherapy. This is a very important study that I think it's important because Dr. Kernberg supported this and was a part of the study. If I remember, this is the Spinhoven research from Holland. It's a critical study for a variety of reasons. They compared schema-focused therapy to transference-focused therapy. What I want to point out about this study that's critical, this can be read, came out in 2008 in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, was number one, in spite of rigorous training by manuals, in spite of ongoing supervision, and in spite of not being able to tell the difference in the coding of the sessions between the different therapists, therapists emerged as one of the primary determinants of the outcome. Transference focus, schema focus therapy, the therapist, there was significant variability in outcome between the therapist. What else was what seemed to account for the difference between the therapist? Well, I'm not going to be a big surprise here. The alliance. Therapists who had better outcomes tended to form better alliances with their clients. So it really comes down to us in a contextual model, who gets to determine the quality and the nature of the treatment. And what our team has been arguing, following on this, is why not ask the patients about that alliance? Since it seems that historically, clients' views of the alliance are 3 times better predictors of outcome than the therapist's view of the alliance. Are you holding on to this? This is a fairly radical idea, but the implications follow. If it's about us, the providers of treatment, then we better find out, are we engaging that client on this day in this place by asking. Again, significant differences between the therapist in the study, alliance ends up being one of the significant predictors of those differences between the therapists. What we do know is that if therapists start getting feedback on a routine basis from their clients, regardless of the diagnosis tested so far, that the outcomes improve by as much as 65%. The chief change is that clients are much less likely to drop out of services.
I have time to respond because this ends 45, right?
What we're hoping then in response is that there will be transparency in the interaction between the client and the therapist that will share, that they do this in front of the client, that we talk about whether or not there's a good outcome and whether or not we are aligned with that client. This is my reaction to the discussion so far with Dr. Kernberg. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for the discussion. I appreciate... Oh, I don't need that. I appreciate the slight irony And only, I'm sorry that the discussion is in general about treatment rather than about narcissistic personalities specifically, but then I understand your view. If diagnosis is not important, only the relation, then of course this whole panel would not be necessary. Now, I think the general issue of whether illness exists or not, of course, is it goes beyond the discussion here. I think that the fact that a person's illness is related to environmental influences that very often represents an interpersonal conflict and not simply something exclusively internal is obvious. And so from this viewpoint, I think to question whether there exist medical illnesses is an issue that I prefer not to examine further, quite frankly. Regarding the relation between symptom and structure, symptoms are surface behavior. For example, timidity is a surface behavior, a descriptive behavior. But what's underlying timidity may be a complex characterological issue. A person can be timid because they are afraid of being attacked. It's maybe an expression of a paranoid tendency. It may be an expression of a schizoid fragmentation of affects. It may be a defense against exhibitionistic tendencies. In that regard, there are surface structure and deeper structures. It's a general accepted principle in psychology. And of course, those structures in turn may be purely psychological and or have basis in neurobiological structures as well. The personality of the therapist is obviously important, and the relationship between therapist and patient. It is true that Therapeutic Alliance has hundreds of studies that show its overriding importance. Most of the studies are brief therapists of a few weeks in experimental setting in colleges that don't touch the therapists that are done in practice, long-term therapists with severe patients about whom research has only developed in the last 10 or 20 years. We have carried out such studies as well as other centers, and we have found in our studies as well as in other related studies, such as the Menninger psychotherapy study, that the improvement depends on factors in the personality, factors in the treatment, and factors in the therapist, so that to reduce it all to the therapeutic alliance simply doesn't go with long-term treatments. In our own studies, we found that, in effect, the personality of the therapist was important, and particularly four qualities in the therapist. The clarity of his intervention, the relevance of his intervention, the depth of his intervention, and the speed of his intervention. These permitted to predict the effectiveness of therapist. But at the same time, there were patients' predictors independent from the therapist. We found three groups of borderline patients. The usual borderline patient without severe narcissistic features, then the borderline patients with severe paranoid and narcissistic features, particularly paranoid features and dissociative tendencies, with worse prognosis. They did worse regardless of whether they had good or bad therapist. And a third group of patients with severe antisocial tendencies who did worse, again, regarding good or bad therapists. So we can't oversimplify and say it's all therapeutic alliance. It's all in the person who treats the patient as well as questioning whether there's such thing as treatment at all. Regarding the treatment that you mentioned, I'm sorry to say that that's the treatment that has been criticized, and there was a critique of this in the archives of psychiatry where the original findings were published. indicating that the group that applied transference-focused psychotherapy did not have an adequate training, that the manual was not adequately applied, that our consultant never agreed or confirmed that the corresponding therapist had had the kind of training that would be necessary for that treatment approach. So to say that 90% depends on the person and 10% on the symptom, it just doesn't correspond to reality. In the Menninger study of psychotherapy, of study of patients during 10 years, there were clearly three groups of patients in terms of improvement. Patients with what was called in those times good ego strength, we would call that neurotic personality organization, they always did well, regardless of what kind of treatment they were treated with. Patients with severe personality disorder, borderline personality organization, and where a treatment was carried out that was the precursor to the treatment that we have developed on that basis. Those patients did poorly with supportive approaches, regardless of the quality of the therapist, did poorly with straight psychoanalysis, regardless of the quality of the therapist, and did best with a treatment in which transference was analyzed in the hours and support was provided as needed outside, support and structure outside the treatment hours. So the personality of the therapist is important. The match between patient and therapist is important. The technique of the treatment is important. And of course, the what develops in the course of the process may be what is most important, because what we call therapeutic alliance, after all, has to be differentiated simply from idealized positive transferences that very often are helpful in brief encounters but break down in long-term encounters in which more deeper ambivalences emerge. So that positive transference has to be differentiated from an authentic deepening relation with the therapist. That is the therapeutic alliance, and once that is established, that's undoubtedly a very important therapeutic factor. And I think we have to protect ourselves against oversimplification in saying one issue is all that matters, all the others are irrelevant. And regarding, I'm coming back again, of questioning whether there's such thing as an illness or a medical illness, I suggest that you discuss that more in depth with many other people.
Let me encourage you to look at the research data, as opposed to accepting either my opinion or Dr. Kernberg's. Look at both. Look at the data that we're citing. Look at the data that Dr. Kernberg is citing. What you need to look for is studies that are replicated, not single studies, not single case designs, not citations off the cuff about that data. Diagnosis, socioeconomic status, treatment approach. We've looked over 40 years of research data. We've replicated this. We're talking about it accounting for 1% of the variability in outcomes. I didn't say, and I would never maintain, that the treatment approach doesn't matter. What I'm surprised by is how much time typically is spent talking about it when other factors are far more critical to the outcome. If I were a therapist trying to improve my craft, I wouldn't start by learning a new method. I would start by finding out what quality of alliances I did have. Sometimes when I speak somehow, and I don't know how I do this, I'll have to think about it, people get the idea that what we're arguing for is an alliance-based approach to treatment. I haven't told you my treatment approach. I won't tell you. What I said was, in the research that was done on TFT and SFT, that the primary determinant the discriminator between effective therapists and none was, in fact, the quality of the alliance. And that's the piece that I'd be saying. Doesn't say the technique doesn't matter. Which technique do you choose? One that fits you. Because so far in the outcome literature, we don't have a clear clue about which one is best. I know you're hearing different from presenters. The CBT folks say theirs is best for certain things. The EMDR folks say it's best for others. When we compare these approaches in head-to-head comparisons, we find no difference. What does this mean for you? It means when you're seated with a client and you're wondering, what should I do with this client? The research doesn't give you much information, except to say all of these approaches might work. You better figure out what will work with that particular person at this particular time. Dr. Kernberg's comment about it doesn't correspond to reality, I think, strikes to the very heart of the difference between us. Who gets to decide that? Us or the clients? I would say it has to be mutual. Otherwise, we're talking to ourselves. Thanks so much again.
I just wanted 1 minute to go back to the initial subject, narcissistic personalities, because we have such patients, and they have special conditions. What I tried to describe has been shown in many studies, statistically significant. A major source of suffering and deserving treatment. And we have 30, 40 years of experience with treating those patients who are extremely difficult, knowing that a number of things don't work and others do work. And insofar as we have a specific syndrome and we are developing specific ways to deal with it, we help these patients to develop real feelings in relationships and get over the terrible incapacity to commit themselves, to get involved, to love. I think we should not forget the specificity of this difficulty and the possibility of developing specific ways of helping them. That's, after all, our profession. Thank you.
Well, if anyone thinks that they can enliven the interchange with a question, we'll be glad to have you say it into the microphone. We have just a few minutes left, though.
Okay, I have a quick question. I do family therapy. One of the parents in a family is narcissistic personality with a lot of narcissistic rage. How do you work with families to help them accommodate a parent's narcissistic personality?
Okay. Can you hear me? Yeah. If you have one member of the family who seems to be the patient, you first have to evaluate to what extent it is really his problem, or to what extent it may reflect a family constellation, a family pathology in which he has been the selected patient. So it's not clear that he's necessarily the one who is the main culprit, so to speak. And the first thing I would do is to evaluate the family in total, to evaluate him, his spouse.
I'm treating the child.
You can't hear me?
She's treating the child.
You're treating the child. I would, of course, then you have to evaluate the child, the family structure, and both parents. And in that, it might show whether the main difficulties are his and how he should be helped. The fact that he has rage does not necessarily indicate that he's a narcissistic personality. So you first have to find out what is his problem, his pathology, to what extent does it reflect a pathology of the parental couple, and that will determine the course of action. In most cases, even if one of the two spouses is more seriously ill than the other one, dealing with the couple's conflict as such may change significantly the situation. The common interest in helping the child may be an important motivation for both of them to try to find new ways. So it may be that couple therapy may be the treatment of choice, or the treatment of the father, or the treatment of the choice of the child with social work involvement in helping the family deal with the child simultaneously. It depends on the findings. But if the father has a severe narcissistic pathology, I certainly would recommend then the treatment for him. But it's not clear that that's the case.
We are out of time, and if you'd like to perhaps come up and ask either Dr. Miller or Dr. Kernberg a question in private, you can do that. Thank you all very much for attending.